You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On tonight's show, Hillary Clinton's long-awaited appearance before the US Senate committee investigating the 2012 attack on the US mission in Benghazi. Is it a sincere quest for the truth or a Republican kangaroo court? My guests, Tim Marshall and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including John Kerry's meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, from which the Secretary of State emerges, describing himself as optimistic. We'll try to guess how loudly his teeth were grinding. We'll also look at this weekend's end of Kirchnerism as Argentina votes, or is it in fact the beginning of the Kirchner revival? And we'll find out why Vladimir Putin is so popular with Russians and why Robert Mugabe is so popular with Chinese. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, live from London on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are once again Tim Marshall, former diplomatic editor at Sky News, now editor of thewhatandthewhy.com, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University. Welcome both back to the show. We will start tonight in Washington with yesterday's confirmation by Vice President Joe Biden that he would not seek the Democratic Party's nomination for president. The odds on former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton have shortened still further, which of course lends added focus to her testimony today to the Senate committee investigating the 2012 attack on the US compound in Benghazi, which did, of course, occur on her watch and which left four Americans dead, including Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens. Oscar, the obvious question, I guess, first, which I suspect has a rather obvious answer, but nonetheless, let's do it. Is this committee, do you think, a serious, rigorous and impartial attempt to divine the truth, or is this the Republicans just beating up on Hillary?
To be very sophisticated, no. It is impossible to think about the committee and what it is doing without the political backdrop. This is to be associated with the elections. And when you have one of the members of the committee questioning the credibility of the committee he's part of, you have to begin to think whether or not this is serious business.
Tim, why is the Benghazi attack more than 3 years later, why is it still such a thing? I mean, it was a terrible and dreadful event, certainly from the Americans' point of view. I think it was the first ambassador lost at work since 1979.
That's right.
But what's stopping America, or what's stopping someone like Hillary Clinton from saying, or America just accepting, that the world in general, Libya in particular, is a dangerous place?
Well,
these things happen.
That's pretty much what she spent the afternoon saying. Look, it's a dangerous place, and she paid tribute and all the rest of it. Look, there's 12 people on this committee. Seven of them are Republicans. Five of them are Democrats. If you take her out of the equation, this might be over already. Every time that an incident like this happens, you'd have to do lessons learned and were the things that we could have done.
Of course, it's
quite okay to be this investigation, but it has gone on the best part of 3 years. It's got an unlimited budget. They're spending millions and millions of it. And if it wasn't for the Clinton factor, I think they would have put it to bed by now. There's been several investigations. Nothing has found that she was directly in the chain of command that led to any things going wrong with security. And the whole security issue, there's a slight red herring. They keep hammering away at security and whether things should be upgraded. But that was only ever about the embassy in Tripoli. It was never about what happened in Benghazi. Now, there were mistakes made without any question, but it's just that I don't think they laid a glove on her. But because of the emails that she's hidden,
a private server,
which she should never have used, and which she has then deleted, and which she has been, you couldn't accuse her of lying, but she has been economical with the truth on it over for years. And so they know, the Republicans know, and the Republican side of the media in America knows, if they can keep this fire burning, they can keep still painting her in a negative light because there'll be that question over her.
Oscar, I was struck very much by the tone of her opening statement, in which she did sort of very much assume the high ground. She was reflective and statesperson-like, went out of her way to pay tribute to Ambassador Stevens and the other American lives lost, clearly trying to rise above any suggestion that this is the partisan bun fight that it clearly is. Is there actually a chance, just from a base, possibly even cynical political point of view, this could actually work out badly for the Republicans if she can actually make them look like they're conducting a point-scoring exercise?
Hillary's a very intelligent politician, and I would say that it is already working against the Republicans. In fact, by taking the high ground, and I'm sure she will do the same on Thursday when she's going to be pressed on the subject of her emails, she will try to appear as states-like. She will try to appear as if she were already the president, and the press will hone on and focus on that. And that will be, of course, the best strategy. I'm certain that that's the way she's going to conduct these hearings.
I think she's under more pressure on the emails than she is on Benghazi, because there have been several investigations into Benghazi, and it hasn't come close to her. The emails, there has clearly been wrongdoing by somebody. And I think she's going to come under a lot of fire. You probably saw the debate she was in, the presidential, the Democratic convention debate, yeah. And the senator for Vermont that's up against her, he actually turned to her during the debate and said, you know what, we're all sick of the emails, aren't we? Let's just drop it. So even her political rival within the Democratic Party wants to just shut that whole debate down. But it's not going to shut down, and it is going to be a factor, along with Benghazi, right up to both her nomination, if she gets it, and then right through the campaign.
But the issue is that, I'm skeptical on whether these would speak to those who are not already against Hillary.
Yeah.
So actually, I welcome Senator Bernie Sanders' point on that debate. You know, he wanted a debate on policy rather than these gimmicks.
Okay, well, let's move on now to Clinton's successor of Secretary of State and possibly predecessor as Democratic nominee, John Kerry. He's been in Berlin today meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been making bewildered headlines all over the world this week by claiming that Adolf Hitler was essentially put up to the Holocaust by a Palestinian cleric. The primary focus of Kerry's meeting with Netanyahu was, of course, the recent spike in violence in Israel and the Palestinian territories, which has seen 9 Israelis and at least 49 Palestinians killed. Tim, John Kerry rather pointedly rose above any opportunity to refer to Netanyahu's somewhat peculiar remarks about the role Grand Mufti Haj Amin al-Husseini may have played in leading Hitler on. How concerning are those remarks? I mean, they have been instantly and roundly condemned by all sectors of Israeli political and historical opinion. Even the chief historian of Yad Vashem has just said that Netanyahu is just flat wrong.
And even more damaging, Merkel, standing next to him in Germany, said, you know what, actually, it's the Germans that did it.
Yeah, it was us.
But for people who didn't follow the background, it is true that the Mufti of Jerusalem, just before the Second World War, was a leading proponent of the Nazis and supporter of the Nazis.
This is all true, yes.
Yeah, it is true that he met Hitler. It is true that he encouraged Hitler to exterminate the Jews. All that is true. But to then go on and argue that that is why the Holocaust happened, which is what Netanyahu did, is just utterly nonsensical. He's made himself look ridiculous. In his own country, the headlines across the political spectrum are giving him a hard time.
The editor of Haaretz has used the phrase, has lost it.
Yes.
Prime Minister.
And that's what you wonder. He's under an awful lot of pressure because there's a much more important thing, not more important than the Holocaust, but more important than arguing about the reasons for the Holocaust is the what's going on in Israel and Palestine at the moment. And he's managed to take that away. He's deflected attention. And it seems to me he is rather tired at the moment.
Diplomatically put, Tim. Oscar, it's not a secret that relations between Netanyahu's administration or administrations and this White House have not been, they've not been known for their bonhomie, I think it's fair to say. At this late stage in the Obama administration, how much patience with Netanyahu does this White House seem to have left?
Well, I think whatever patience they had, it can be seen to have been exhausted when John Kerry's careful chosen words are, you know, we are cautiously optimistic, which is just diplomatesse for we no longer care.
I don't know what
about
to do.
Yeah. What do we do?
I'm cautiously optimistic translates as I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually admitting that we've got very little play here. In fact, the whole world is not focused on the Israel-Palestine situation.
Yeah.
It is a minor conflict going on when you look at the rest of the Middle East. I wrote a piece about this for a newspaper last week saying if you look at the regional and world reaction to what's going on, everyone else is saying, are you at that again? Oh, God. Well, anyway, look, about Syria and the millions of refugees and the hundreds of thousands of people dying, it's just not a very big story.
Which is a tragedy of this because, of course, there are, you know, we know what is happening on the streets of Jerusalem. We know that, as Palestinian writer Raja Shehadeh would put it, they are nearing extinction. We know those things. So this is the proverbial tragedy becoming a farce.
Yeah, and all right, look, let's fall out over this. I am interested in the story, of course. It's just that if you really put it in the round, it is a small conflict that is not that important in the great scheme of things. Having said that, what the Palestinian leadership are doing yet again is sacrificing an entire generation of their people to be killed by inciting them to this violence, especially Hamas. The TV programs, they're teaching little nine-year-olds how to stab people because they're Jews. And so they're even generating the next generation of Palestinian children to be sacrificed. They lose every single time. They die in far greater numbers every single time, and every single time their leaders keep telling them, keep going, kill people. It's a disaster.
That's important, the story, the kind of reactive violence that emerges out of an atmosphere of continuing violence. You know, we were discussing just a few days on this program the fact that Palestine tragically is no longer on the news. Yeah. And it is only in the news if some kind of violence takes place.
But hang on, why is it so tragic? Why aren't we talking about what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where far more people die? Why are these people's lives so important?
Well, if only because, you know, these people's lives is as important.
Yeah,
I
am being
lives.
Disingenuous. I do realize it's the epicenter of three faiths, and
there is a serious question there, which obviously you in your previous role as diplomatic editor of Sky News, you would have had considerable pause to consider. I'm sure to what extent, because I've wondered about this myself in my own limited experiences of reporting from Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, to what extent the violence is driven or encouraged or fueled by the fact that a small amount of violence there commands global attention.
Oh, that is part and parcel of it, because, you know, it is the propaganda of the deed. And if nobody took any notice, it might calm down. But no, I mean, look, the root cause of it is occupation and violence. But violence being a two-way process, that is the root cause of it. But if it was not for the leadership, particularly of the Palestinians, promoting violence day in, day out, in the cartoons, in the op-eds, in the videos, day in, day out, into television children's programs, there would be less violence and there might be more chance. And, of course, the Israelis, they can certainly play their part as well. But it is partly this thing about getting the world's attention. That then gets people's attention to start funding things. The Middle East media whips people up into a frenzy because their dictators always use that. You concentrate on what's happening to our Palestinian brethren.
Not that we actually have any intention of doing anything to help.
We're not going to do anything to help the Palestinians. And what's more, while you're busy concentrating on that, we can repress you.
Oscar, among the other sort of bits of choice diplo-speak that John Kerry unburdened himself was, he said, if parties want to try, and I believe they do, want to move to a de-escalation, there are a set of choices that are available. What is not clear to me is where John Kerry is seeing this evidence that de-escalation is actually what anybody wants.
I don't think he's pointing towards concrete evidence, but more, you know, the kind of thing that you were saying before, Tim. The fact that actually, if the parties to this conflict wanted de-escalation, they could achieve it.
Yeah.
But the part of the problem here is that we have, you know, this is the proverbial case of mimetic violence, you know, mine is bigger than yours, I'll hit you if you hit me, and so on and so forth, which is the very definition of tragedy, I might add, and that is why this is still a very important story. But again, it would be difficult to find concrete evidence to be optimistic about this.
I just don't think what he said made the blind bit of notice, or what the EU said. It's just no one's actually doing anything concrete to reduce the tensions from the outside. They're just mouthing platitudes. Now, on the inside, you could easily argue that if Netanyahu said, right, I'm going to change the policy back because the stone throwing can now be met by live fire. So that has outraged people. You could set that back. You could make a better case that the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is not being changed. I don't personally think they are changing it, but they could try a bit harder to persuade people that it's not being changed. And of course, from the other side, you could stop promoting videos of clerics stabbing the air with knives and saying, cut them into little pieces, and having little children on television programs saying, we should go and stab the Jews. Yeah, there are things they could do on both sides. Nobody's doing anything.
Oscar, it's always difficult to predict what's about to happen anywhere, never mind the Middle East, although you rarely lose money by betting on things getting worse. There has been some suggestion that, you know, what we are witnessing is the beginning of a third Palestinian intifada. Do you see it that way?
I don't think so. I don't think so. That, to me, sounds as an exaggeration. Again, there is a lot of rhetoric, and we have seen quite a few symbolic gestures, including the UN flag and the raising of the flag and so on and so forth. But what that gives testimony to, in my opinion, is the very fact that both parties do sense that the rest of the world is losing patience and or just attention, while at the same time, they keep on believing that if you ratchet up the rhetoric, you will appear stronger and win elections. Of course, that has happened on the Israeli side. The rhetoric did win an election.
Yes.
And that's part of the problem. We have, very unfortunate circumstances, politics and the media, but clearly lack of will.
Just finally on this, Tim, I did want to borrow your long experience in passing diplo-speak to return to that statement of Kerry's, in which he said, and I quote, "I would characterise that conversation as one that gave me a cautious measure of optimism that there may be a way to defuse the situation and begin to find a way forward." Now, does that translate broadly as, I'm out of ideas, I'm frankly past caring, do what you please, and...
That's a little harsh. I think it says I'm out of ideas. I think the key word there is may. There may be ways. Well, yeah, I mean, there are always ways, so there may be ways. No, he just didn't say anything. It's, by the way, it's not a third intifada yet, certainly not as we understand it.
Certainly.
The first and second were both organised. At the moment, there's very little evidence that Fatah and PA are behind this. Hamas are stoking it, but it is not an organised, and it is much, much small scale. It could turn into one.
Just a very brief final thought on that. Is it potentially more dangerous, though, or at least as dangerous, because it's not organised, and therefore nobody can, even if no one's switching it on, that nobody may be able to switch it off?
Yes, I think that's true. Well, this follows a pattern. I mean, the pattern of stabbing and running people over, or stealing a bulldozer and driving it into a bus stop full of people, that actually emerged last year, but it's really accelerated now. And now it has become viral, and it has become the e-intifada. And this goes back to what both ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they said, look, do lone wolves. And lone wolf has become much more prevalent, and you cannot control that. And when it's on the internet and it becomes a meme, this is something reasonably new, and we're looking at it and trying to understand it.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, with Tim Marshall and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner prepares to move out of the Quinta de Olivos, but what does she leave behind, and will she be missed?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city. You know, it's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Tim Marshall and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, whatever the voters decide in Sunday's election in Argentina, one certain result is the end of an era. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has been the dominant personality of 21st century Argentina as an influential first lady and subsequently president. And many observers suggest that the weekend's election, in which she is prevented from standing by term limits, is in effect, easy for me to say, a referendum on her legacy. Oscar, the word that comes up in everything you read about Kirchner is divisive. What is the nature of the divisions in Argentina? Who is broadly for her and who is broadly against her?
Look, I have a problem with that presentation in the news, if only because this is more old-fashioned than it looks. You know, it's old-fashioned class warfare, in fact. If we were in the 1970s, we wouldn't be trying to unpack it in a more sophisticated manner. The legacy is quite simple. Kirchner base comes from a working class and lower income families. They are the majority of the country. Therefore, they feel satisfied and they will continue to support her legacy in elections, which is why Daniele Scioli is most likely to win the election. On the other side, you have those more well-off, the traditional bonaerense, and so on and so forth, who see her as a populist, divisive character who has squandered taxes and ratchet up rhetoric. The point is that Kirchner is, as you put it, a very influential figure, and she is not done. She will continue to intervene in politics, not only there, but my bet is at the regional level. Secretary of UNASUR?
Why not?
Well, I mean, it is hard to imagine her going or indeed doing anything else quietly, especially if her protege does win either on Sunday or in the runoff. There is already some suggestion, Oscar, that she might come back and take another crack at it in 2019. Is that really likely?
I don't think so.
She would be 67.
She would be 67 by then. She has had enough health issues,
yes.
and that's important. And actually, that is not the tradition in Latin America. In fact, you know, we have seen in the 21st century a sort of upward trajectory, the confirmation of an upward trajectory. You become president, you're very influential, you get reelected. If you leave a legacy, then you move on to either the regional level or the global level. So UNASUR, the community of Latin American states, or even United Nations-based posts, as Michele did most recently.
Tim, speaking with your diplomatic correspondent's hat on, what have you made of how she has projected herself and Argentina to the rest of the world?
I think she's been reasonably successful. I mean, she's kept the Las Malvinas Falklands row brewing very nicely, and she's got support from many Latin American countries for the Argentinian view on the Falklands Islands. So she's done that quite well. She was also canny enough to align herself with Cuba and Venezuela, the left of center governments in the Caribbean and Latin American sphere. And it is a coincidence that because of the constitution that she cannot stand again. But the timing is interesting as well, diplomatically, because Venezuela is about to go for its own election, but it's clearly softening in its stance towards America because it's not getting help from Russia and other things. Cuba is clearly changing. Bolivia, maybe not so much. But so that sort of axis of clearly left of center Latin American, you obviously know far more about it than I do. I'm not sure that her successor, if he wins, is quite as left-wing as she is.
He's not. And in fact, the meeting between Dilma Rousseff and Obama earlier this year did point towards a softening of those relations. Of course, part of the reason is also that the U.S. was and still is quite isolated diplomatically in the region. So America also has to...
Did you see what he did there? The U.S. is isolated.
Yes. Well, it is. I mean...
we shall return to the consequences of the Argentinian election, I'm sure, at length next week. But finally tonight, we will stick with the theme of populist demagogues whose popularity baffles many outside observers, because it has been quite a
good week all round for those of that ilk. So not only does Kirchner leave office with approval ratings better than 50%, Russia's President Vladimir Putin appears more popular at home than ever, and in Zimbabwe, the inextinguishable Robert Mugabe has been favoured with China's Confucius Peace Prize, previous recipients of which do include President Putin and indeed Fidel Castro, who in fairness hadn't got the planet blown up for nearly 50 years by the point they gave it to him. Tim, Mugabe first. Are the Chinese just trying to be funny?
Yeah. Well, it's it works for me. I mean, it's hilarious. Mugabe has beaten Bill Gates. Now, who's done more for the planet to promote peace? I don't remember Bill Gates slaughtering tens of thousands of people in Matabele land. No, that wasn't
Bill Gates.
It was a while ago. And overseeing this catastrophic destruction of the economy of a country. No, didn't think Bill Gates did that either. So Mugabe's got it. It is entirely comical.
On this awful software, mate.
There is Windows 7, 9, to, yeah. Apparently, Confucianism in the 21st century, the definition of it is universal harmony in the world. That's why Robert Mugabe has been given it. It is clearly China, it's all part of China being the parity superpower in a few decades' time. They're outside of the Nobel Prize. If the Nobel Prize people are going to give Nobel Peace Prizes to Chinese dissidents, well, they're going to come up with their own prize, and it's called the Confucius Prize.
It is brilliant. The prize committee chairman, in defence of their award, said that Mugabe had provided Zimbabwe with a better standard of living than could be found in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, or Libya. Do you think the Chinese could afford Oscar to set the bar a little bit higher?
We should stop making those comparisons. also, the Mugabe and Kirchner on the same. They are not. They do not belong to the same sack. We should stop being so naive about these prizes, particularly peace prizes. They are geopolitical. Some people might say that giving the Nobel Peace Prize to Obama can be also considered problematic.
There's a difference.
I'm not saying that they are
individual people with their own biases that make up the Nobel Prize Committee. And yes, they do things for political reasons.
Exactly.
But this prize is about a state deciding this.
It's obviously geopolitical, and I don't think that the Nobel Peace Prize in particular is less geopolitical. I might even argue that the Literature Prize is becoming so. The point here is that we should not be, too naive about these things. Also, what I found particularly interesting about this story is the fact that on the one hand, one of the members of the jury did say that, at least some members had strong reservations about Mr. Mugabe,
imagine,
to say the least, while another one, the official line, seemed to suggest that what they were celebrating was the Mugabe years of Pan-Africanism, kind of the Mugabe of the independence and decolonization years, which is, in a sense, the way in which China does present itself in Africa, as a companion of those years. But of course, we all know that plenty has happened in between those times and these times. And what comes to my mind is Frantz Fanon's warning about the pitfalls of national consciousness.
We should look also briefly at Vladimir Putin's recent surge. According to the state pollster, which may be significant, VTSIOM, he's now just short of 90% approval. Tim, how seriously is it possible to take that? How many Russians are entirely comfortable when the agents of the state turn up on their doorstep asking what they think of the president, suggesting that they don't like him terribly much?
I agree with you that 90% is a little bit high, but I don't think we're at North Korean levels here, of 99.9. I'm pretty confident that actually he is definitely popular in his own country. And there's a number of reasons. If you go back to when he took over from the catastrophic rule of Yeltsin to now, Russia is in a much better place economically. Never leave freedoms to one side for a moment. Also, Yeltsin oversaw the humiliation of Russia on the world stage, including in Kosovo. This is the guy that won the wars with great brutality in Grozny, but he's put them back on the world stage. Now, the poll was taken before the recent bombing in Syria, which is actually quite popular, but it was when he had clearly outmaneuvered the Americans over Syria. And I think the Russian people, who are very, very nationalistic, I think they absolutely love that he has restored them back onto the world stage.
It is an extraordinarily potent thing, pride. We will have to leave it there. Tim and Oscar, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's edition. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlos Strunk and Antonia Matzhauser. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Gaia Lutz will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. It was, in fact, Chris Chilvers who is the studio manager. It is a reversal of last night's similar mistake when he was mistakenly credited, so I guess it all works out eventually. This show returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, also hosted by me, and I will get the studio manager's name right. I'm reasonably confident. For this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.